Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you are a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us. We're here to talk about Mothman Prophecies, released in 2002.
Good year. A good year. I met my husband that year.
Oh, mm-hmm. I don't know what I was doing. I was in college. I was in community college, living the dream.
Living the dream.
Yeah. This is a good one. I'm excited to talk about.
Cool.
This one.
Yeah. But are you as excited to tell me what's new with you?
I guess so.
Go for it.
Let's see. So I went to Lobster Fest.
Yes.
And it was in Minneapolis. It was really fun. There were like 19 of us, mm-hmm. 18 or 19 of us.
Yeah, I saw a picture on Facebook. I was like, damn, that's a big group of wow people.
Yeah, and some people were not even there. Like, wow. Some people didn't even make it to brunch because of the night we had before, mm-hmm. which was a little bit nuts. But we got together. We met up in Minneapolis because our friend, his wife, they live there.
Right.
And her baby, his baby and her baby.
Their baby.
Their baby was due like any day.
Was the baby born while you were there?
Like the day we flew out.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Aww. That Monday.
And they should name it Lobster.
Lobster, yes. And then our friend got his residency in Minneapolis as well. So mm-hmm. he moved over the summer from Manhattan to pediatric ICU residency.
Wow.
In Minneapolis. And then we have a bunch of friends who live in Michigan, and they drove, and some friends who live in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And
good
other
location.
Yeah, and another group, or two other friends that I guess met through the guild, and now they're dating and live together. They like came and moved in with each other.
Yeah.
But and they live in Minneapolis as well. So we're like kind of figuring out where we're gonna go, and I want to say our gamer tag names, because mm-hmm. Victor and I were like, let's just go to Minneapolis and people can come or not.
Yeah,
because there was like, I want to say, 7 people in the guild who live there already.
Right.
So we all got there and we played cards and had good drinks and good food and had a great time, and we're there for 4 or 5 days. And I wasn't able to make it over to Paisley Park because that's where Prince was lived and resided and recorded a lot of amazing things. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't get tickets. So we went to a mural. I went to the Prince store in Minneapolis airport and I got a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And it's the tag inside the t-shirt says the Prince Estate.
Ooh.
And I was like, ooh, this is fancy. Really cool. This is really cool. This is definitely nicer than my Prince shirt that I got at Ross for $6. Then I came home and I was like, my throat's scratchy. I'm not feeling so great. And then I looked at my Discord and I saw like 4 or 5 of the lobsters were like, so I have COVID. In the end, I think 13 of us all got COVID.
How did I not know that you got COVID at Lobster Fest?
I don't know.
It just didn't come up in any of our texts.
No. Well, it just felt, not to minimize people who have like a lot worse experience. Mm-hmm. But it just felt
like
a bad...
You mean like Victor?
he wasn't even there, though. He went to Kentucky,
right,
to the Bourbon Trail. So somehow he got out unscathed, mm-hmm. and didn't catch this lobster illness. So, yeah, I came home and then saw like 4 or 5 of our friends were like, oh, I tested positive for COVID. Mm-hmm. Test yourself. And I was like, cool. And then I'm like, oh, I have the COVID. And then the kids were dropped off like that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, so to their dad, like, I have COVID. Do you want the kids to stay here or do you want to pick them up? Because Victor's not here.
Yeah.
So basically they'll just be feral in the other side of the house. And I'll be like just living in my own filth in my room with the dog. So he picked them up and I was sick for like 4 or 5 days. It just felt like a gnarly cold.
Yeah.
like the flu felt worse.
Okay.
But I just think it's this variant where it just like it's annoying and you kind of feel like tired and achy.
Yeah.
But it's not like the first time I had flu and or excuse me, COVID in 2021, I was like, I'm dying. But then I was fine.
Yeah.
Obviously I didn't die. So that's about it. So because I was stuck at home, I rewatched all of Girls.
Oh, I've never seen that show.
It's weird. It's like when I first watched it, the kids were really little because it came out in 2012, I want to say. Okay. Maybe I'm misremembering. But I feel like my patience for them is a lot more forgiving now that I'm older.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
At the time, you just got like annoyed with the characters?
Yeah. I don't know. I just thought I had no patience. I was like, God, you're so entitled, little bitches. Like, not, I mean, not really, but I just got irritated. So I watched the whole thing. Each episode's like 30 minutes. Yeah. So, and when you're sick at home for days, then you don't have anything else to do.
Right. It flies by.
It flies by. As you
well recently know. Also just experienced.
So I watched also Too Much, also Lena Dunham project as well. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed that, and I thought it was kind of funny, and then watched All of Girls, and then watched just some scary movies, and listened to books, and just kind of played World of Warcraft. I played World of Warcraft because I had to level, and when we parted ways at the Minneapolis airport, Victor was going to Kentucky with Ben to go on the Bourbon Trail, I was taking a flight back home, and he's like, you need to level your character, and I was like, I'm going to be too busy living my life.
Just kidding. Not busy at all.
Not busy.
No life was lived.
And I was like, oh, I'll be too busy living my life. Anyways. <yeah.
laughs> And then you coughed directly into his eyeballs.
Yeah. So I leveled a bunch of my WoW character and then just, you know, was a bum. But then I managed to eventually get into my classroom and do a little stuff once I was better. But school starts next week.
Yep.
Not looking forward to it, but. I'm going to Nine Inch Nails tonight with Victor.
Wow.
So that's our last kind of little hurrah before school starts.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
Anyway, that's the quick and dirty. I went to Lobster Fest, had a great time, then felt like crap. Now I feel better.
Yeah.
That's the end. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I also just, I got to do my, annual friend gathering. We both have those. Mine is not based around a gaming group, but rather.
There's not 16.
No.
17 lobsters who all get together.
No, it's, four girlfriends from high school. We kind of try to alternate. We get together every summer and then we alternate between expensive summers and cheap summers.
Mm-hmm.
So like the, expensive summers, like we'll get a VRBO somewhere or, you know, like drop some money on where we go.
Yeah.
And then the cheap summers, this is the third time that the cheap summers have been at, our vacation house in Arnold, 'cause it's free. And so I was up there from Thursday to Monday. It was just like, it's very, like I said, it's the third time this group has been to that house. And so I like to think that for them, it's like kind of, it's familiar and comfortable at this point. Like everybody always sleeps in the same beds that they did the time before. Everybody knows where everything is.
Mm-hmm.
That's
nice.
We try to come up with something different to do each time. The first time we stayed there was 2020 because it was COVID and we're like, well, we can't fucking go anywhere.
Let's get together and cough in each other's mouths.
Yep, pretty much. But that time, so Big Tree State Park is really close to where our house is. And so, again, like outdoors, that's a great activity for during COVID. And so, like on that visit, we went and did the state park and did a hike and everything. And then the next time we were up there, we visited the town of Murphy's and, you know, went to some tasting rooms and did some shopping and went and saw a movie in Angels Camp. And so then each time I'm like, okay, well, now we've already done that. We don't want to do the same thing every time, even though we're at the same house every time. And so this time we kind of brought more activities where we like manufactured a paint and sip for ourselves. Mm-hmm. 'Cause one of the friends is actually an incredible artist and painter. And so I was like, you could be like the host of the paint and sip and like guide us or whatever. And then of course hers turned out incredible. And then, you know, 'cause we're painting trees naturally, 'cause that's what's up there is trees. And then the other three of us did varying levels of quality trees. And then one friend was like, I'm going to paint flowers. We're like, have at it.
It's going to go rogue.
Pretty much. But yeah, it's just very, like you described, like chill, eating, drinking, playing games. We always like try to, you know, we watch some like 90s or 2000s movies. We watched Clueless this time since it's the anniversary this year. So it was a good time. And then something else good came out of it that one of the friends in this group is Abby, one of our loyal listeners that you finally met at my birthday this mm-hmm. summer.
Yeah.
She recommended to me a podcast I had not heard of that Brett Goldstein does. Mm-hmm. Like it's called like Movies to be Buried With
mm-hmm.
or something. And so I, you know, pulled it up and I was scrolling through the episodes and, there's a lot of, people that he has, guests that he has on that I've never heard of cause they're British, I guess. But the couple of names jumped out and I was like, ooh, I'm going to give this a shot. And so, I listened to the episode where he, had Lee Winnell on
mm-hmm.
and it was like, it was very cool. And it's like, it's very little Brett Goldstein. Like he's not doing very much of the talking at all. And he's a very funny guy, but he's not funny on, or at least this one episode, like he wasn't funny on the episode because he was just kind of like fangirling about movies and Lee Winnell and his career and everything. Like it wasn't the Brett Goldstein show. He was just like super excited to be talking to somebody who makes movies, which was kind of.
And such amazing. I mean, for people who don't, I mean, any listener should know.
Right.
And sorry to, if I've insulted you, maybe names aren't your thing, like just popped
but
to your
yeah
head,
like but he talked Saw. About Saw and like starting his career with that and his
Insidious.
Partnership with James Wan for so long, and then I didn't realize that he and James Wan kind of like parted ways in their partnership in the middle of the Insidious series. And so Insidious 3, which is your favorite, is the mm-hmm. first one Lee Winnell directed because mm-hmm. that was the first time after James Wan went off to do other projects. And I didn't realize Lee Winnell also did The Invisible Man with Elizabeth Moss mm-hmm. and the Wolfman movie that just came out, which was mid.
but I loved Invisible Man. I loved that approach.
Yes.
And Elizabeth Moss is so great.
Yeah. And he talked at length about like how that kind of came to be and the inspiration behind it. So it was like the first part of the podcast was kind of talking about his career and his experiences making films and everything. And then Brett Goldstein asked him movie that you laugh the hardest at, movie that makes you cry the most, movie that scares you the most, like your best film of all time, the movie you rewatch the most. And mm-hmm. and it was cute because, you know, as it went along, at one point, Luna was like, I keep giving you the most basic answers. Because for like the best film of all time, he said Citizen Kane. For the scariest movie of all time, he said The Shining. Like he was just
like, are you just like repeating an AFI?
Pretty much. Like, and then it was like one of them was it was like the movie experience that like was most significant for you. And he mm-hmm. said Star Wars. And so I was like, OK.
He's like, I didn't realize I was such a basic bitch.
Kind of. But at the same time, he was just like, I mean, it's honest.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why that's a widely, like those films are widely held in that regard because it's true.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so he doesn't have to like come up with something obscure just to prove to everybody that he's some sort of cinema insider because we know he is.
Yeah. I mean, we can see what comes out of his crazy brain.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But it was interesting to hear someone who makes films talk about why they like certain films or not. Because when he said Citizen Kane, I was like, ugh. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I've seen it two or three times. And he actually had the audacity to say it wasn't boring. And I'm like, girl, it's boring. if it's not boring, it's at least too long.
Sure.
But he started talking about what made it stand out from the films of the other era in terms of the cinematography and the camera work, which is not something I really noticed just as I wouldn't call myself a casual movie watcher.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very, very active and prolific movie watcher, but I don't know shit about making movies. And so there are a lot of elements like that that I'd be like, I liked that better than that. But I couldn't tell you like, oh, well, he was doing this camera, you know, strategy or this trick and everything, where at the time it was very like static camera placement in all the movies being made.
Right.
So that part was really, really interesting. Yeah.
Right.
So I think I'll be going back to that podcast and check in.
That sounds fun.
There is an episode where he talks to Joshua Jackson.
Oh, your fave. Gotta yeah, love Josh. So
I'm saving that. Josh. I'm saving that for
You're like, I'm saving this for at home alone.
Yeah, with a glass of wine. Yes.
You're like, what else do you have to say, Joshua?
Tell me more. Enlighten me. Tell me more. Oh, I want to know what we have in common.
Yeah. So we have a movie podcast. I would only say I'm an expert in a way that I really enjoy the viewing of it.
I enjoy the consumption.
I like hearing sometimes how it's made. Mm-hmm.
From like a trivia standpoint.
Yeah.
The science of it.
The minutiae, yeah. I don't understand. Yeah. Like, I don't understand, you know, scenes and all that stuff and how to block whatever and boom mic. I don't know. I'm like, what do I see in credits? Boom mic. Mm-hmm. Craft services.
What is a grip?
I don't know anything. Key grip, best boy. I don't know anything. So, but I don't know. That sounds like a fun podcast. I might check it out too.
Yeah,
I might. I just might. There's something I was gonna bring up. Oh, we need to see Weapons. I know. We didn't bring this up and before the podcast, but mm-hmm. I'm just gonna put that out there because
that's not the one with the actress from Wolfman, is it?
It is.
It is. Okay, and she was the one that made Apartment 7A2. That same actress.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's made by the guy who did Barbarian.
Right.
And people are saying it's like very, very good, but it comes out on the 8th. So we'll have to figure out.
Make a date.
We have to make a date because I was like, I have to see this movie because mm-hmm. it looks
wild.
It looks wild.
Yeah.
But the premise, have you seen the trailer?
Victor sent the trailer to us, even though he knows how I feel about trailers. I think that I watched the first couple minutes and then as soon as it like intrigued me, like, oh, this looks like it's going to be good, I turned it off.
Sure.
So that I didn't see too much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we need to see it and I'm very excited. I love seeing... you know, remakes are fun, but I like seeing a wild new... Like
something super something original.
Something crazy where I'm like, oh, that's wild. Who thought this up?
Yeah.
That's crazy. All right. So to our recap, let me just name a few of the people who are in it. Richard Gere is the main character. Mm-hmm. He plays John Keel. Deborah Messing plays his wife, but she's only in it for like a short time.
Right.
And then Will Patton, who he is a guy you'd be like, oh, it's that guy mm-hmm. in a lot of movies. But more recently, he was in the remake of Halloween.
Yeah.
He plays the sheriff.
And I love him in Remember the Titans.
He was like conflicted because he wanted that job. He's kind of a jerk. And then
he wasn't a racist or an evil man. And so he ended up on the right side of everything.
Yeah. Right side of history. Yeah. I like him in a lot of things.
Yeah. He's great.
So, and then Laura Linney, who... we love her. Yeah. We love her so much.
Well, and I love her and Richard Gere together. Like, them together in Primal Fear is one of my favorites.
Yeah. It's been 20 years since I've seen that.
That's one of those ones that I keep rewatching, and I think that if, like, a random person heard, like, that, oh, she watches Primal Fear a lot, where it's, like, because it's a movie about, you know, like, sexual assault and crime and things like that. Like, ew, what's wrong with her?
Sure, true, but...
But...
We consume as a society, and women in particular, we do watch and listen to a lot of podcasts, watch a lot of movies, news of stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, we're a huge consumers of true crime.
Yeah.
So, while it is a little demented, Katie, mm-hmm. I agree it's a good one. So, I need to probably watch it again, but I have not in a long time. Yeah. So, I'll just start. So there is, I don't know if they're called title cards.
I usually use that phrase. And then when it feels wrong, I might say text on screen.
The text on the screen. Yeah. Okay. So it says, based on true events, which occurred in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. John, who's played by Richard Gere, as I mentioned, is at work. And he is a reporter who works for the Washington Post. And he's headed home to his wife instead of going to the annual Christmas party. His boss gives him a little bit of a hard time, and he's like, no, I can't. Mary's waiting for me. So the two of them meet with a real estate agent, and they're looking at a house, which, interestingly, on Christmas Eve, I guess the real estate agent's, like, serious about making that sale.
Was it Christmas Eve, or was it just Christmas time?
I want to say Christmas Eve, but no, Christmas time, maybe?
Yeah, well, because the bridge collapse was on Christmas Eve.
Yeah,
so
right.
So it had to have been like, oh, but this was years later.
Yeah.
After. Anyway, yeah, doesn't matter.
It was sometime later that he was like, I think I want to say 2 years later, and then his coworkers trying to send him a. But I'm jumping
the gun a little bit. Christmas parties usually aren't on Christmas Eve. Like your work Christmas party would be like before everyone takes off for Christmas, like whatever days they get off for Christmas.
I guess that makes sense. Mine is on usually before Christmas break, and we have to buy our own beverage because we're teachers. Yep. And we have no money.
So this is now a work Christmas party podcast.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
Tell us about your Christmas party. Okay. So the two of them meet with a real estate agent. They look at a house and then they try out the house closet for a little smooching until they're caught by the estate agent. And John's like, we'll take it.
We'll take it. And then he pulls the closet and then he closes door it. Again.
They're so excited about this big, huge purchase and finding their dream home together. And Mary is driving them home in their Volkswagen. Is it a Volkswagen?
I was not paying attention to the make of the car.
I don't know. Anyway, they're chatting and excited about their new home, all the possibilities. Suddenly, Mary sees something in her vision in the form, kind of, it's like red lights, moth
flashing.
Flashes. Yeah. And she's startled and slams on the brakes. She goes unconscious and she's on the steering wheel. And John doesn't really know what happened. He's like, Mary, Mary. Oh, and then he calls 911 to get help. And in the hospital, John is at Mary's bedside. And she asks him if he saw it. She's like, did you see it? And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And she's like, I think something is wrong with me.
Yeah.
You know, so so she gets an MRI. And it turns out she has glioblastoma, which is a rare form of brain cancer, and it's in her brain, which would make sense that that would be the cause.
It would trigger some sort of
this event. Mm-hmm. So the surgery couldn't get it all out, and she also had to go on chemo. John laments to his coworker, he's like, who came to visit him and check in on him, who's Steve from, that's his character's name in Sex and the City. That's the only reason I know who he is.
Yeah.
He's like, we're just house hunting 2 weeks ago, and now it's this.
She's dying.
Yeah. He's like, I feel, it's like the universe is like, oh, you're here. You're doing really well. Bam.
Yeah.
Not anymore. In her hospital room, Mary tells John, she's like, I'm so sorry. I feel like I ruined everything.
Yeah.
And she's worrying, and John is like, no, you didn't. This isn't your fault.
Yeah.
Basically, but. She's just kind of very despondent. Mm-hmm. So John returns to the scene of the accident, and he noticed some kind of weirdness in the grill of his car. It looks like a weird melting kind of weird, formation on his grill. Mm-hmm. And then later John gets a call about Mary, and he rushes back to the hospital, and he hears the worst news. His wife has passed away. So sometime later, Joe's cleaning out Mary's stuff out of her hospital room, and it's a nurse or orderly, and he comes and tells him, he's like, she knew. Mm-hmm. She knew something was going to happen.
Yeah.
And she was drawing angels.
That guy has an interesting concept of what an angel looks like.
So John's looking at her drawings, and they all look pretty similar to a cryptid, the Mothman. It's they're just very unsettling.
Yeah, they're like kind of shapeless, but, you know, they are winged, which is, I'm sure, why that guy was like, she was drawing angels, but they're like black and kind of like unsettling and malevolent, some more so than others, and then kind of like increasingly so as he flips through the journal.
Yeah, the drawings made me think of scary stories to tell in the dark with all those charcoal drawings, illustrations, which are just like, ooh, you know, very strange and creepy and unsettling. So 2 years later, John's working. He's a commentator on TV. He's kind of a big deal at Washington Post. He's just, you know, plugging along, keeping busy. John's friend's trying to set him up, and he's resistant, and he declines the offer.
He's just not ready
yet. So he's busy. He packs a bag, and he heads to Richmond for an interview with the governor. He's like, I gotta go. I have an early interview. And his friend's like, the interview was, like, postponed until the evening, so you can't actually go out tonight. And he's like, nah, I gotta go. So he gets on the road. He just seems, like, super, like, you know, unsettled in his home, agitated. Yeah. He just has to get out of, he seems like he's kind of crawling out of his own skin a bit with the passing of his wife. He doesn't really know what to do with himself with his free time. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. Well, and it's also
like when you experience a tragedy like that, then when that same time of year comes around again, like it can be triggering. And so, you know, like she died
right around then.
Yeah. He would like associate that with Christmas. And so then like probably that time of year, like is harder for him too.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. So on the road, he calls his friend, he apologizes. He says he's up, you know, he's up. It's a weird time. He's pretty wired. He's like, it's 1 AM. I just, you know, I like to meet your friend. I'm really sorry. But I'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
Essentially. And he's driving for a while and suddenly his car has kind of a complete, like all the lights in his dash out. Turn off and his phone turned off.
Yeah, everything nopes on him.
And his watch stops. It's all very strange.
Yeah.
So he starts to kind of hoof it and he's walking in the dark. It's winter. There's woods all around him and he keeps looking over his shoulder. Like he has a feeling something is watching him a little bit. So he walks to a nearby home and a man entered, Gordon, who's played by Will Patton. And he's like, I was expecting you. And then he drags him with a shotgun. Yeah. And he drags him into the bathtub.
Which is, I mean, if you're going to blow someone away with a shotgun inside your house, a bathtub's a good place to do it.
It's easy
cleanup.
Smart.
Yep. It's just good sense.
So he drags him to the bathroom and he's like, this is the third time you've shown up.
Yeah.
The third night in a row.
At the same time.
Uh-huh. And he's like, he tells his wife, he's like, call Sheriff Mills. Mm-hmm. Call Connie. And so she does. And, you know, Laura Linney, who plays Connie, shows up and she's like, she has a very cool head. And
She's very Fargo.
Yeah.
Frances McDormand in Fargo.
Like she's very bright and has a cool head. And she's known all of these people her whole life.
Yeah.
So they really trust her too. And so she's like, John's trying to explain and she's like, let's listen to what Gordon has to say. Like, what's going on? Why are you having this reaction? This like visceral reaction. And he's like, you know, he's certain that this is the third night in a row at around 2 a.m. where someone has been coming to knock.
This man.
He's shown up. And, you know, he's like, in the previous night, I went to the door. There's something that wasn't right. Mm-hmm. I said, get away from my house. And he like threatened, you know, he's like, you're trespassing. You need to leave. If you come back again. Yeah, I'll shoot you. And so he's like, there's something about this guy who kept coming and he just seemed creepy.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really say why.
Possibly just the fact that he keeps showing up at your door in the middle of the night.
At 2 a.m.
You could be a totally normal person and doing that is creepy.
Creepy, yeah. So John says there's something wrong. He's like, I've never been here. I don't know these people. He tells him his name. He shows he offers up his wallet for them to look at his driver's license. Mm-hmm. And they find his Washington Post ID. Sheriff Mills takes him out of the house to go into her cruiser to like figure out a place to stay or whatever.
But she's really just like kind of diffusing the situation because I mean, I think she recognizes that, you know, he hasn't, even if what Gordon's saying is true, he hasn't really broken any laws. It's not like the situation where she's gonna arrest this guy. And it kind of seems like she's talking Gordon down and just de-escalating everything and getting John out of there.
Yeah.
And then like hopefully trying to figure out, like what get the to the root of the matter. On. But in that moment, it just kind of like, let's just everybody call it a night.
Sure. Yeah. Let's get this. We'll talk about this tomorrow.
Yeah.
So Connie on the way out, Connie asks Gordon's wife if she saw him. Saw John.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, but I heard knocking at 2 a.m. And he kept getting up to go answer, you know, the door.
Yeah.
So something was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So then Connie drives him to town and she says she's like, you know, I recognize you. And, you know, from his work.
His TV show.
And he's kind of like, oh, okay. She's like, we're not all country bumpkins. You know, like I watch the news and all that stuff. She also comments that Gordon and Denise have never had a problem before. Like, she's never been dealt with him in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is kind of a little bit jarring. But she's like, but, you know, a lot of weird things have been happening lately. So, kind of oh, you know, whatever. She also wants to know why he's there in the middle of the night. And John is a little cagey about it.
Yeah.
He leaves the car because she drives into a nearby hotel. And he goes to get a room at Point Pleasant Inn. So at the front desk, John is asking the desk clerk, you know, where are they located? He's trying to find them on the map. And he's like, that's the wrong side of the map.
Yeah,
the
he's like, clerk. We're right on the state line. And he's like, looking, and he's like, no, the state line with Ohio.
Yeah. And inexplicitly, he's on the other side of the state.
Yeah.
And
like only a couple hours have passed, and he drove like 600 miles.
Which is like basically not quite possible. So the next morning, the mechanic also informs John when he goes to follow up about his car that he can't find anything wrong with his car and it just shut off for no reason. So while in town, he also sees Gordon and he goes up to him and he's like, are you sure it was me that showed up? He's like, yeah.
He's like, I'm not crazy.
I'm not
like
crazy. It,
yeah.
And then he tells John that Connie did check on John. He checks out and he's like, if Connie says that, I'm going to take her word for it.
Right.
You know, he trusts her.
He's
completely.
Not going to keep causing trouble about this, but he also knows what he knows.
Yeah. So he also explains that John explains to Gordon, he's like, I don't know how I ended up at your house.
Yeah.
Somehow inexplicably, I traveled hundreds of miles in a few hours. And then Gordon is like taking it all in. He's like, and they're calling me crazy. So then later that night, John's outside of Gordon's house, a little bit down the road a bit, just kind of watching. And Sheriff Mills shows up and she's like, I thought I'd find you here. So the two of them are sitting in her police car watching, doing a little stakeout.
Yeah.
She had mentioned that Connie told him, or he had mentioned that Connie told him that like weirdness was happening in town lately and he presses her on it. And she's like, okay, good people are coming. Oops, sorry. I went all the way down to the bottom of my recap.
Oh, that's a wild ride.
Yeah. All right, here we go. So he presses her on it and she says, okay, good people are coming to me and reporting weird occurrences and sightings. And these are people who are pillars of the community. Right. Like not your town crackpot.
Yeah.
Like people who are, they're like embarrassed to come to her with these reports.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, weird lights, phone calls, him showing up.
Mm-hmm.
And then she shows him a drawing also that was found, given to her, I think. Mm-hmm. I can't remember where she got it, but it's very similar to the drawings that Mary had left behind in her hospital room. John, and he's a little shaken by this as well. So John and Connie go to talk to the woman who drew the picture. She got a picture from a woman who was like, I saw this outside of my house.
Yeah.
So they go talk to her and she explains that she was looking outside of her window and outside of her kitchen in the middle of the night. And she saw like a big, huge form of something in a tree and it had red eyes and it was looking at her. And then it just took off into the sky. Then they kind of, John and Connie kind of check out the tree where this entity or whatever it was, and there's the similar markings on the tree that was also on his car, which is also a little bit strange.
Yeah, a little off-putting.
So John goes to talk to the fire chief as well, and he had recorded some weird calls and strange sounds that had been made to the fire station, and he recorded it, and there's like he's like, sometimes it's just like these weird, like static clinking weird sounds.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's someone who's on the phone just talking very, very fast. Yeah. So too fast for him to understand. He says he got the phone number changed and the calls started being made to that new number.
Yeah. He's before I even gave it to anyone.
Yeah. He's like, nobody even knew what the number was. John's intrigued and wants to work, you know, continue finding out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But also his work is like, hey, what the hell? Like, you went missing. You were supposed to go interview the governor. And, you know, you need to get back on track with your work.
Your job.
your actual job with the Washington Post, which
is a big deal.
Yeah. So he talks to a couple later who are hooking up in their car. they're outside of the cement munitions plant or cement plant or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about, like, just they're caught and heavy in the back seat and suddenly strange lights start happening weird sounds, like they have to cover their ears because it's like too much for their ears to handle, and it injures her boyfriend's eyes. And he's like, my eyes were all swollen and one never quite healed, and he has
like still red and
like a bloodshot eye. Hold on, I need a drink.
She can't make it through a single episode without a drink, folks.
It's a coffee drink. With a lot of booze.
No, with kidding. A lot of booze.
It's my COVID. Okay. And one of his eyes never quite healed. It's still bloodshot. So back in his room, someone starts calling John and no one's on the line. And he looks a little bit, that's weird. And he looks at a photo of his wife. All of this is very intriguing to him because of its inexplicable connection to his wife.
Yeah, it's all bizarre and like you can't not easily explained. And I don't know if like the suggestion is like for him being a reporter that like a reporter maybe not necessarily be more open-minded, but a reporter is going to be a curious individual, somebody that's going to ask questions and like expect to look deeper into a situation. So I think making him a reporter was like, you know, really contributed to how he handled this situation, because it was like the fact that it aligned with the loss of his wife, which he hasn't gotten over at all.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's like, I'm going to go talk to this person. I'm going to go talk to these people. Like he approached it like it was a story he was investigating, which, you know, wouldn't happen if he was just like, you know, a barista that this happened that wound up in some town, you know?
Yeah. He's somebody who doesn't just take a superficial explanation and be like, oh, well, that's that.
Yeah. Or okay. Be like, how did I get here? That's weird. I'm going home. Like, no, I'm going to stay
well,
here.
Well, see you later. And I have to fly because it'll take me 10 years to get back home. Let's see. The following day, Gordon approaches John and he describes the horrible headache he woke up with the previous evening. He went to the bathroom to get aspirin and he saw an entity in the mirror. He heard a voice that came out of the sink. Kind of reminded me of Pennywise a little bit.
This is all Pennywise. Mm-hmm.
And it said, do not be afraid. 99 and will die.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of drew everything. He kind
of wrote it all down. Yeah.
Wrote it all down. It made me think of like Elise. Is it Elise? In Insidious, where she's like drawing all the stuff, hearing stuff, and drawing all of these channeling information. And on the drawing, there's like the weird drawing similar to Mary's, and it says has the word Denver. It has the numbers 99 and also 9. So he's like, it's kind of, this is so weird. This has never happened to me. And
this is what the voice from the drain has told me.
And I think it's also important to note that Connie, other people are like, this is not Gordon. This is not like, he's not the town
crazy
person. Yeah. So they're obviously worried. So Gordon gets checked out by a neurologist and they're like, you only had a crazy migraine. Mm-hmm. It's not the same affliction that Mary had with her very rare kind of cancer.
And I love that John's like there talking to the doctor with him. Mm-hmm. He was like, are you sure it's not glioblastoma? And the doctor's like, I mean, that's incredibly rare. And no, there's no evidence to suggest that that's what's happening here. I'm like, why is John and his neurologist with him?
Yeah. And to think like that, like you would just get a quick appointment with a neurologist.
Well, maybe in a small town. Oh, yeah.
And also, is there a neurologist situation
in Point Pleasant?
Maybe
that was why John didn't have a lot of confidence in this guy's diagnosis, because he was a small town GP.
I'm more believing of the Mothman than I am of this ability
to get a neurologist appointment
for the same day. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I'm having a hard time. It's like a scream with a hairbrush. You know, it just bothers me.
Sticks
in my craw. So, he's like, they're kind of like, he's like, it's not a migraine. I think something else is going on. Gordon's not satisfied with the doctor's explanation. So then later over dinner, at a diner, Gordon is wondering, you know, if he had the same thing that his wife, you know, I think I had the same thing your wife has.
Yeah.
And John's like, I don't really know, you know, who, I don't know. And suddenly there's a news story on the television, and it says that a flight out of Denver, I want to say the flight, they say nine.
Yeah, it's flight nine.
Flight nine, which is
there's never strange. Been a single digit flight number.
Right. And it says 99 passengers have been killed. Mm-hmm. And they're like, stunned. Mm-hmm. John and Gordon are stunned. And he's like, I don't have words for this, basically. Like, yeah. This is
staggering.
Yeah. So then later John calls an author / expert, Alexander Leake. He expresses interest in precognition and prophecies, but Mr. Leake isn't interested in speaking to him about it. He's like, it's all in the book. I can't talk to you. Bye. Yeah. And he hangs up. So then later John, I mean, he's stonewalled. So
yeah.
That's that. Later, John has a conversation with Connie about Gordon and his dreams, and she finally admits that she has had a strange dream herself, being in cold water, their presence all around her, and she's trying to grab onto the presence, and suddenly she starts sinking, and letting go feels really very good. There are lights below her in the water, and then a voice speaks to her and says, wake up, number 37, wake up, and then she wakes up from her dream.
Yeah.
So there's weirdness, everyone in town. Yeah, but kind
to
of
be fair, like with nothing else going weirdness. On, like everybody has weird dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So that dream, like under different circumstances, she might have been like, huh, that was a weird dream. And then just gone about, you know, which is probably why, you know, she didn't like mention it right away because like it didn't share anything in common with any of the other reports, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, I guess because of all of the other weirdness going on, she was like, me too.
She's like, people are complaining about having weird dreams. I guess that would be kind of weird. Yeah. I don't know. But I'm sure it's nothing anyway. So the following day, Gordon tells John that he met the guy who told him about the plane crash at the old cement plant.
Good old Indrid.
Yeah, there's a crazy light. He couldn't catch his breath. He was hot. And a figure walked up to his truck, and he looked human, but something was wrong with him. The voice said, don't be afraid. My name is Indrid Cold. He said, in a place this size, equator, 300 will die. Wait for me. I will return. I will see you in time. And then Gordon pulls out a newspaper out of his pocket. And it has a news report about a very recent earthquake in Ecuador that has estimated to have killed about 300 people. Mm-hmm. And he's just kind of like, I don't really know what to do with this.
Yeah.
So then that evening, John and Connie are listening to another weird phone call that the fire chief had received. Their listening sesh is interrupted by Gordon, who called to tell John that Adrian Cold is here. He's at my house.
Yeah.
And John's like, put him on the horn.
Yeah, right? Let me talk to that bastard.
let me talk to that son of a bee. he kind of covers the receiver and it's like, Indrid Cold is at Gordon's house. Yeah. You need to go over there.
Yeah.
So Connie leaves to go to Gordon's house to see what the heck's going on.
Yeah.
Indrid Cold's voice is very strange,
it's
to
sexy.
Say the least. Huh?
It's sexy.
It's like,
it's like he's trying deliberately. Bobbing. Yeah. Like he's trying to make it very like suave.
It's like, it's, I don't know. It's deep. It's kind of like staticky.
Yeah.
It seems not human.
Yeah. Like humming kind of.
Yeah. So he's talking to him and, well, it's funny because John's like, let me talk to him. And Gordon's like, yeah, okay.
Here you go.
Here's the fun. So he speaks to him and he's like, hello, John Klein. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, cool. John.
Indrid knows me.
John asks who it is and he offers some information to John that only John would know.
Right.
About his father. About John's father, and that kind of stuns him a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then he asks him, he's like, where's my watch? He takes it off because it seemed to know things about him. And
yeah,
it was very,
and so he's like testing him, like, well, yeah. Prove it. You know, what am I doing with this?
Yeah,
like,
he says, where's my watch? After he put it in his shoe and then slid his shoe under the bed. And he goes, it's in your shoe, under the bed.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, what the fuck? And he's like, what am I holding? And he's like, chapstick. And you're like, and then John just, oh, okay. Yeah. And he,
well, doesn't he like start looking around like there's cameras in here? There's got to be cameras.
He looks out the window. He shuts the curtains.
Yeah.
He thinks that something's watching him. Then he asks him, you know, what are the lines in this book, page, whatever, paragraph, you know, tell me what it says. And mm-hmm. Indrid Cold is able to recite them perfectly back to John. So he is
convinced.
He's convinced that this is something otherworldly about mm-hmm. Indrid Cold. John asks, what happened to my wife? Mm-hmm. And he goes, you already know. You were there. And, you know, and that she cannot be found by looking. And she... he will see her in time. And then there's a loud blast of noise in John's ear. And that's the end of that conversation. Connie, at the same time, arrives at Gordon's house and wakes up Gordon. He was asleep and he does not know what Connie is talking. Yeah. He's like, we were asleep.
No, he's like, I've been in bed since 9:30.
Yeah, I'm not. This is, and I was not on the phone. So because John recorded this conversation, he's able to get voice analysis on the call. The range of Indrid Cold's voice is not normal, and it didn't come from human vocal cords. But John has to also, he's like, well, that's crazy. And then he's like, I gotta go. I've been putting off my job.
Yeah, I'm gonna get fired.
Yeah. And so he makes the motions to go back to his job and do what he's supposed to. But instead of going to his job, he goes to talk to Alexander Lake and question him. Mm-hmm. John able to finally convince him to talk to him because he shows
this is
him
the expert.
Yeah, he shows him the illustrations of what people have been seeing in Point Pleasant, and he's like, "Okay, follow me." Mm-hmm. So they go and talk. And he talks about, Leek tells him that people see the moth before tragedy. And he gave instances in history like Chernobyl and other times that mm-hmm. people were seeing this entity. They also show up in cave paintings and have existed forever. John wants more of a solid explanation. And Alexander says that John noticed them and they noticed that he noticed them. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're kind of messing with him at this point. He tells Alexander about his friend Gordon and about all of the people who have seen it in Point Pleasant. He tells John something terrible is going to happen there and you should not go back.
Yeah.
Leek also tells John that whatever brought him to Point Pleasant brought him there to die.
Not what you want to hear.
Yeah. So, of course, he runs back to Point Pleasant and tells Connie.
He's like, I gotta save my blonde.
Yeah, Connie tells him that 15 more people have seen this, reported seeing this thing to her, and two of them are police officers, mm-hmm. Which I guess means that they're, you know, reliable.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he also sees, you know, Gordon's wife who doesn't say hello. She's kind of upset, and Connie explains, oh, she left Gordon.
Yeah, she just couldn't hack it anymore.
Yeah, she left him and he's also fired for just not showing up to work anymore. John also tells Connie that, you know, he's like, oh, she's like, well, how did it go talking to the ex, you know, John Leek? And he's like, oh, he wouldn't see me. Mm-hmm. So he's very cagey, doesn't want to reveal that.
Yeah.
That something is going to happen. John eventually finds Gordon on a bridge alone and the two of them talk. John tells Gordon that he doesn't think he is crazy and Gordon tells him that that he keeps talking to him, and he doesn't understand all of this information and these messages he's getting. He also tells John that it talks to him, too, and that these things are real.
Yeah.
Later in bed, John sees his wife in his, you know, he's sleeping, and she tells him, John, I just want you to be happy. Which is so sad. Like, his grief is palpable through the whole movie. Then John gets a wake-up call from the front desk that he didn't ask for.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
This is your wake-up call. He's like, I didn't tell anybody to send me a wake-up call.
Then Gordon calls him. His voice is a little garbled. He's like, oh, finally, I got through to you. And he tells him, you know, he's right about everything. And it's end of the call, ominous.
Yeah.
So John, you know, he runs over to Gordon's house and finds the doors open. He finds Gordon sitting dead of exposure against the tree. And he's also been, the coroner's there, other, you know, Connie shows up and they're like, he's been dead for about 8 hours. And Connie's like, when did Gordon call you? And he's like, an hour ago.
Yeah. But he was just like, it's so creepy. Like, he's just sitting up against a tree. Like, he just sat down and froze to death.
Mm-hmm.
And his eyes are still open. And it's really spooky.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. And also, how in the world would he have called him an hour ago?
Yeah, if he was already dead.
Dead already. John goes to the police station and on the way, he feels like he just saw a glimpse of his wife. And we see Mary outside of the police station. Connie's like, oh, someone was looking for you, asking for you. And she starts to describe Mary, mm-hmm. asking, you know, questions about John. She's like, I'm sorry. Connie's like, she says, you know, she's sorry for ruining everything. And then John starts to like really unravel. She says, you know, when he shows her a photograph, she goes, is that your wife? And he's like, yeah. She's like, yeah, well, her hair was different.
Yeah,
and
then probably not the same person.
Yeah, and she tries to walk it back.
Yeah.
Knowing rationally, there's no way it could have been his wife.
Right.
So then back at his hotel room, he starts getting strange calls, which Indrid Cold calls saying, I'm sorry, I ruined everything.
Mm-hmm.
Back to him. Finally, John really can't take it anymore. He goes to Leek and he asks more questions. He's like, this is not stopping. Leek tells him that the same thing happened to him. He got messages about a building being, you know, collapsing and killing a bunch of people. And no one believed him.
Mm-hmm.
And people eventually were killed because people didn't believe him. Then he was investigated. His kids stopped talking to him, and he tells John he will never understand these creatures. Hold on, let me take a sip of water. John's like, I want to know what's going on. I want proof, you know, of what's, you know, that these exist. Mm-hmm. And Leek is like, what's more important, having proof or being alive?
Yeah.
You know, John says he needs to know.
Yeah.
And Leek says, we aren't allowed to. Like, this is something beyond all of us. It's like trying to find answers about angels or aliens or something that's, like, not possible.
Yeah.
So then John is a little obsessed, and he thinks because of this connection it has with his deceased wife, he's having a hard time letting it go.
Mm-hmm.
So he waits and waits with his phone and his recorder. He's waiting for call back.
Good old
from
Indrid
Colds, just so he can have more to go on, more information.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, Cyrus calls him, his boss, about the governor and interviewing him because he'll be making an appearance at the chemical plant on the Ohio River. But then somehow the warning is spoken to him about a great tragedy on the Ohio River.
Mm-hmm. So he's like, aha!
Yeah, so he tries to tell Connie, who's going to help facilitate this tour with the governor, because she's the sheriff and she has to be part of it.
Right. For security.
Yeah. He's like, cancel it. Can't, you know, you shouldn't be there. Cancel it.
There's going to be a disaster.
There's going to be something not good. And she's like, you've lost, you know, she was on board for a long time. And now mm-hmm. she's like, yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
So she rebuffs him. She's like, I don't believe in Andrew Cold. And he also admits that he saw Leek. In the end, he saw him.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, because she lied to him, he lied to her about even being able to talk to
the first author. Yeah.
And he revealed that Leek said that these messages are warnings of something very troubling, mm-hmm. catastrophic happening.
Yeah.
So then John tries, because he's the press and he was supposed to go interview the governor, he goes to the governor and he sounds like a raving lunatic. He's trying to get the governor to cancel it. He's like, something bad's gonna happen, you can't go. And the governor's like, dude, get away from me. No. And so then the governor wants to he gets into the car and he asks his assistant or whomever helps, you know, work for him,
yeah,
get Cyrus from the Washington Post on the phone.
Yeah, because his reporter is a fucking
crazy
lunatic.
Mm-hmm. So then later, John watches the news that the chemical plant inspection, the governor visit, everything was fine.
Yeah, nothing happened.
Then John gets a message that Mary, he's like at a bar or something, and it's in his hotel or somewhere. I'm not entirely sure. He gets a message on a little sheet of paper that says he'll get a message. Hold on, let me go back. That Mary will call Georgetown at noon.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in a frenzy packing so he can go back home so he can talk to her.
Yeah.
So he goes back home in a rush. He kind of brushes off Connie. Connie's worried about him because he's kind of lost it. He's sitting there waiting. He has his recorder. He has his phone ready in front of him. And it's like maybe 10 minutes to noon. Connie calls him and she tells him, I booked you a flight. You know, it's Christmas Eve and you can't be alone.
Yeah.
And Connie also tells him that Mary isn't calling.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm waiting for Mary to call. And she's like,
she's not
going to call. She's not calling. And she isn't anywhere near Indrid Cold.
Yeah.
If she's anywhere, she's nowhere near him. And she's not calling because she's dead. She's just giving it, like, laying out cold, hard truths on John.
She's like, listen, asshole.
She says, whatever this is, it's lying to him. And he needs to be around people and not alone.
Yeah.
Because
it's Christmas time.
Yeah. He starts weeping and he tells Connie that he just misses her so much.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets off the phone. He's like, okay. You know, he kind of is accepting what Connie, this message that she's given to him. The phone starts ringing at noon. He's tempted to answer it, but instead he pulls the phone out of the wall. Then the ringer starts going off again, inexplicably, with no phone wire attached to the phone.
And that's just like, how many movies does that happen to?
You're like, ah!
Like the person freaks out and pulls it out of the wall or rips it apart or smashes it and then it just rings again.
It's the ghosts. Okay.
it's witches.
It's Bigfoot. It's the cryptid.
Bigfoot's just trying to call Mothman. They're buddies.
Yeah. So he doesn't answer and he's resolved to go spend time with Connie and her family and just leave this behind, this obsession that's very unhealthy. So he gets in the car and he drives. And he ends up in traffic on the bridge that connects the Ohio and West Virginia. He's waiting. And he's not on the bridge yet. He's on the road that leads to the bridge. But there's a lot of drivers kind of standing outside of their car, kind of looking on, be like, what the heck's going on?
Total gridlock.
Mm-hmm. Total gridlock. And there's a lot of cars there, including Connie in her police cruiser. Or it's not a cruiser, but it's a Jeep.
Yeah.
So John isn't, he asked somebody, like, hey, what's going on? And the guy's like, oh, I think something, he's looking too. And he's like, I think something.
Like the traffic lights are screwed up or something on the other side of the bridge. So nobody can finish crossing.
Everyone's just stuck. So John's about to get back in the car when he stops and he turns around and he hears Indrid Cold's voice say a great tragedy on the River Ohio. So he starts to run and the bridge starts to shudder. Connie's out of her car. She's also trying to figure out what the holdup is, what's going on. And she has a bunch of presents in her car, gift wrapped gifts. And she, you know, goes, you know, kind of asking around as well. John tries to warn people. One of them who he interviewed, the guy who's like, my eye never healed. And
He's get off the bridge.
He's like, you need to get out. And suddenly a big piece of whatever holds up the bridge snaps. The cable smashes into that guy's car. He starts to run. He starts warning people to get out of the car and run. Connie does too, and pieces of the bridge start to collapse and fall into the river. Connie returns to her car. She gets on her police radio and starts calling for help, and then her car gets smashed. It's a whole big scene. People are like, screaming. Yeah. It's a five minute collapse. But I'm not going to go into the minutiae of that. So eventually the entire bridge collapses into the river, including Connie's police car. So John, of course, jumps into the river after her and he is trying to get her out of the car. After a little bit of dicey moments, he's able to retrieve her and they make it to the surface of the river. And there's just many, many floating gift wrapped presents all around them floating in the river. Connie realizes that, The fire chief walks up to John, and Connie is sitting there with a blanket wrapped around her.
Yeah, this is all like post disaster. Everybody's sitting on the bumper of a ambulance.
And basically, it's like I'm getting too old for this shit. Pretty much.
Give me my foil blanket. I need a minute.
So the fire chief says, you know, there are 36 people who died. It was bad, but it could have been a lot worse because he was there and started warning people to leave, you know, get out of your car and go. And he said 36 people have died. And Connie realizes that her dream saying wake up number 37 was about this catastrophic event. Yeah. And then John and Connie sit in the back of the ambulance, just grateful to be alive and have, you know, made it out of this tragedy. Mm-hmm. The text then reads, the cause of the collapse was never determined, and the Mothman wasn't seen in Point Pleasant again.
Yeah.
And that is, minus all my coughing, sorry, listeners, that was Mothman prophecies.
Woo! Well
done. Did you think it was scary and or creepy?
Yeah, I think I remembered it. My memory of it was like, ooh, that was really scary. And then when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, this isn't really the feeling I remember getting from it the first time. It's very unsettling. And there are some scenes, like the scenes of, you know, John in his hotel room with the phone calls, the scenes with, you know, Gordon describing like his contact and the things that have happened to him. There were some scenes that were kind of creepy, the way that they presented it, and spooky. And like, but overall, I think that I wouldn't say that it was, well, I wouldn't say it was super scary. But the concept and the story as a whole was like, it was very unsettling, and fun. Like it's a little bit of a mystery. It's supernatural, but it's also like practical, you know, like real disaster. So it's kind of like, you know, with that Final Destination thing where it's like the things that are happening are just real life, like disasters, mm-hmm. but there is this like supernatural element, like linked to them. And so that's kind of, you know, an interesting, ride to go on.
Yeah.
Did you think it was scary?
When I saw it in the theater,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it was like just so unsettling,
mm-hmm.
especially like the his conversations with Ingrid Cold, mm-hmm. and the revelation that he was able to kind of read his mind or predict or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting, and just the supernatural part. I didn't think that Ingrid Cold or the Mothman was like out to get everybody.
No.
So it was like,
they don't make it a monster, really.
Yeah. It seemed more like a harbinger of doom.
Yeah.
Like, a little bit like the something's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed it. And I think at the time I was like, oh, this is based on a true story. But really, how much is it based on? So then I read a bunch about the Mothman and the urban legend about this creature and how it was more described as like a big, huge man, half bird mm-hmm. thing with like red eyes or whatever, that would be in a tree.
Yeah, that was an interesting choice in this film to not ever really show the mm-hmm. Mothman. All we saw were sketches. And then sometimes in those flash images, you had kind of a hint of his shape. Yeah. But, you know, they could have gone a very different direction and tried to make the Mothman a character in the movie, like actually show a creature that people were seeing.
Yeah. Like, it made me think of like Midnight Mass a little mm-hmm. bit. Did you ever watch Midnight
Mass? I did, but I don't remember a Mothman in it.
Not a Mothman, yeah, no. But like that creature where it looks like, and you see red, you just see eyes mm-hmm. glowing, or you see like a big winged creature.
Mm, clearly I need to rewatch it.
But it was, you know, the big reveal of what it actually was. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Because that's who I am.
Yep, that's typical Meredith.
I like more of the imagining.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed it. I think that Richard Gere really, I mean, he's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Laura Linney, we love her.
Yeah, she's awesome.
And Will Patton as well. And, you know, I thought it was very compelling and a really interesting story. And mm-hmm. Definitely on a few rewatches, it's a lot less scary than the first time around, which makes sense. But it definitely made me curious to find out more of the story behind, the legend behind Mothman, this cryptid. And it made me also remember, like, oh, my, I need a stuffed animal, Mothman stuffed animal.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was Mothman last Halloween. It was just, it's like a, kind of like a poncho style garment that has a hood, and on the hood has like the big red eyes and the kind of like mothy ear antenna type things. And then it's just kind of like a cape that has like a jagged hem or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those very, very easy costumes to wear that was just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I did that 'cause, in the literature curriculum we use at school, there's a unit on, in the fifth grade books, there's a unit on mysteries. And so in that unit, there's something on Bigfoot and something on Loch Ness Monster. And so we always end up, you know, spiraling off into a whole thing of cryptids every year with my fifth graders.
And Chupacabra.
Yeah, pretty much. And they're like, have you heard of the hoop snake? I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about, Renee? But yeah, so with regards to the disaster, I'm just going to like take this directly from Wikipedia because it there, you know, it's like you say, you watch this is like based on true events. Well, lots of times movies put that at the beginning and it's categorically untrue, you know, like Blair Witch Project. Mm-hmm. And they just want the viewer to think that it really happened.
Yeah.
But the real disaster that this was about on December 15th, 1967, which obviously this movie was not set in the 60s.
Yeah. It was, I mean, they were talking on cell phones. So. Yeah.
It says the Silver Bridge collapsed amid heavy rush hour traffic, resulting in the deaths of 46 people. So that's there's two discrepancies there. First, it was not like Christmas Eve, it was December 15th, and 46 people died. And so it's kind of what would be the rationale for changing that number for the film?
No idea.
Like, was it actually an accident? Like, somebody mistyped something and it was supposed to be wake up number 47?
Yeah. And they're like, let's just stick with it.
Yeah, it's believe fine. It. Nobody
Laura,
cares.
Laura Linney already did it in her scene, so.
And then it does say that two of the deaths, the dead were never found.
Oh, man.
Investigation of the wreckage soon pointed to the failure of a single eye bar in one of the suspension chains as the primary cause, a finding noted in a preliminary report released within 10 months of the collapse. However, to explain why that eye bar failed, a failure triggered by a flaw just 0.1 inches deep that led to a fracture required significantly more time and effort to uncover, with the final accident report taking 3 years to complete. And so that, like, kind of, you know, in the movie when they say it was never determined why it collapsed, it's like, well, in reality it was eventually determined, but not for a long time, you know, because it was a very, very tiny flaw that led to the breakage that led to the collapse. And it does say that the collapse of this bridge led to significant changes in the way bridges in the U.S. are inspected and maintained. Mm-hmm. But of course, this predates our current administration, where nobody is doing any job for safety anywhere anymore. They've all been fired. So
nobody gives a shit.
Yeah. Avoid bridges at all costs. But the other thing that I will mention, because I'm sure I did the same thing, that when I first saw this movie, you immediately like want to do research, want to find out, you know, like the backstory and get more information, because it is, it's captivating.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite episodes of My Favorite Murder, and it was pretty early on because I just looked it up. It was episode 183.
Mm-hmm.
They cover the Silver Bridge collapse as well as all of the actual reports that people filed at that time of sightings of Mothman. And it led to one of the fairly early MFM animated episodes.
Oh, yeah.
With Nick Terry. And I had a t-shirt. I don't know if I still have it, but it had the cartoon Mothman that Nick Terry developed. Mm-hmm. And it said, bye, bitches. Because one of the things that they thought was really amusing is these reports said that the Mothman doesn't like take off like a bird,
mm-hmm.
that he just rises up into the air, which is something that they utilized in this movie as well.
Yeah.
But they were like, you know, just like a helicopter, like he just goes straight up. and of course they're like, you know, flipping people off or whatever. So my t-shirt's not suitable for work.
Aww, with the
Mothman with his middle fingers up saying bye, bitches. But that episode of My Favorite Murder and the MFM animated bit about it, when they're describing, it's mostly about like the appearance and the behavior of the Mothman, mm-hmm. went into that cartoon, are just so great. They're so hilarious.
I know that there was an old episode of Unsolved Mysteries, mm-hmm. about the Mothman.
Okay.
And then in the reboot, there's a Mothman Revisited episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we were recording when I told you that I tried to watch it.
Yeah.
And I fell asleep. Mm-hmm. But I know I watched it before because it already was played through when I – but I probably watched it a few years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all worth watching again if you're, mm-hmm. very compelled to be like, I need to know everything.
About
all of this. Yeah. I need to know. And I also think that last podcast on the left also did some episodes or an episode probably about Mothman. Because, you know, we love him.
Yeah. Well, it's just, there's something so beautiful about cryptids because they're not monsters, mm-hmm. right? Mothman, like you said, Mothman never that poor guy's eye never got better. But the real, you know, the real reports about Mothman, it's frightening because you don't understand it. But it's not trying to harm you. Bigfoot's not hurting anybody. We can't even catch them, son of a bitch. Like, the Loch Ness Monster has never attacked anyone. Like,
Nessie would never.
Would never. So these cryptids, it's the, and that's actually, it's funny, that's one of the themes of that literature unit that we do is, like, why are people fascinated by mysteries? Mm-hmm. Like, why do mysteries appeal to people? Why is that the basis for so much of what we produce in terms of fiction and, like, and writing and films, and then also real, like, why we seek out these mysteries that exist in real life? Like, what is it about the human condition that makes that draws us mm-hmm. To these unexplained things?
Yeah.
It was pretty funny too. I saw a meme the other day that was like, you know, watching Unsolved Mystery, like me watching Unsolved Mysteries, my friend, wouldn't you just call those mysteries? And it was like me sitting there eating edible food. What are you talking about? Because just pointing out that it's kind of redundant to call them unsolved mysteries.
Who can say? It's an unsolved mystery.
Yeah, there have been mysteries that were mysteries and that then were solved.
Yeah.
Not JonBenet, but...
No. But, I mean, a lot of those shows, like America's Most Wanted, other things where they were like, this is what happened, it's unsolved.
Mm-hmm.
And
call in with tips.
Yeah. ended up with, you know, some sort of conclusion.
Yeah.
With that. So, yeah. Like, I mean, one of the biggest ones was John List mm-hmm. finding him on America's Most Wanted.
Like how many years later? Like decades later?
Yeah, like based decades on later.
A bust.
Yeah, it was like a clay bust.
Yeah,
that was made to be like, this is what he looks like now, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they were right, 100%, and including his glasses. So I mean, it's really fun. And if I ever make my way over to Point Pleasant, they have like.
A statue.
They have a statue. Yeah. They have like memorabilia and like other stuff.
They have
and...
like a festival too, uh-huh. like an annual event.
Yeah. I'm like, I want to go to a Krampus festival mm-hmm. in like Norway. I would totally do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to go to the Mothman festival.
Go visit Mothman.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just have to make sure that the some lobster fest someday gets planned somewhere near that so that you can make it a little excursion.
I know. I'm like, I need to go to Mothman.
I got to go see Mothman. Who wants to come? Yeah. But yeah, I think that, you know, maybe that's why this movie like doesn't, you wouldn't say it was like very scary or it doesn't retain its scariness because, you know, it has that element of mystery. It has that element of what you don't understand is scary or what you don't know is scary.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not, you know, an actual threat or a villain or a bad guy or a monster. It's just, it's life.
Yeah.
The inherent danger and risk of life.
There's also the book written by that author who this is what the movie's based off of.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I want to say there were like many deviations from reality, mm-hmm. you know, what really happened in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's also fun to check out as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, you could explore a lot of stuff connected to this topic.
I'm going to be a Mothman expert.
Yes. You can borrow my costume anytime you want.
Forget school. And I'm just learning about the Mothman.
Quit my job and go into my Mothman hole.
We love him.
Yeah.
But if anyone's not watched this, I mean, I'm sure I spoiled it, but it's a good one. And but it has a lot of the typical early aughts movie elements.
Yeah.
I show this to Charlotte, but I think she might think it's boring, honestly.
Yeah. Grace probably would too.
Yeah. But, you know, it's fun. It's a fun one.
Yeah. It's not super scary. It's not violent. It's not, you know, inappropriate in any way. So it's a pretty safe one.
Yeah.
If you were showing it to like a younger kid, it probably would be. It'd be scarier for like a 10 or a 12 year old.
Yeah.
You know, our 15, 16 year olds don't want to spend the time
on it. They're too jaded.
Yeah. But a younger kid, it might be a good level of scary without being problematic in any way.
Sure. It's funny that you bring that up because I was watching or it was the other night, I was finally COVID free. So I picked up the kids and they came home, and Charlotte was in her room. Who knows, doing what, whatever. So, and then Deke and I were hanging out in the living room. He's like, let's watch something. And I was like, okay, what are you in the mood for? And he's like, something scary, something about a real murder. Like, I want to watch something that's mysterious.
Oh.
And I was like, oh. And so I didn't want to scar him for life. Mm-hmm. I was like, time for Hereditary.
Jump right in.
Take a page out of Katie's book. I was like, what about an episode of the Unsolved Mysteries reboot?
Mm-hmm.
So we watched one, and I think he was annoyed. He's like, in the end, he's like, it's unsolved. They never figured it out.
It's right in the title, bro.
He's like, I need answers. Oh my and I'm God, like, poor I know. Kid. I know. So he thought that was annoying. But then we watched an episode of Sherlock as well. We're like, let's just watch a little bit like ooky spooky mysterious stuff. So he's dipping the toe. He's he's a very sensitive, sweet guy. Yeah. So I can't get too degen, you know, right away.
Yeah.
But that was fun.
Yeah.
Like, Mom, I want to watch something creepy and weird. I'm like, are you
come to the right place, my friend.
You asked the right mother.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, like, with I really should stop talking about Grace, because, like, I've told I don't know if I've said this on an episode or if I've just told you that she is not really a big fan of scary movies anymore.
She's like taking a step back.
Yeah. She doesn't like the lingering fear that she's left with after a particularly scary movie. But at the same time, you know, my son has started like really embracing the horror movie genre. And so I, you know, have replaced her with him in every way. And he and I, the last couple we've watched, we've been working our way through Insidious. So we've watched the first three Insidious so far.
The third one's my favorite, you know.
I know. And I've told him, I was like, you know, and I think that there, except for the last one, obviously Red Door was terrible, but the first four are all amazing. And so I'm hoping that
your name is Marathon. I'll never stop laughing about that.
Yeah. it was cute. Actually, there was one point in the second one where it's when the Parker Crane's mother appears to Renee in the house and like backhands her and like knocks her like across the room and knocks her out.
Yeah, she like rings her bell.
Yeah,
she's, like
when that happened, like it's a jump scare because you know, because Renee's by herself and then all of a sudden the ghost appears and then smacks her, and so Tommy was so startled he went, "Oh shit!" So it's so funny to like watch. It was like, it's, my son is a man. He sounds like a man. He looks like a man, and then he like jumped and like just swore like a man when that happened. I was like, that's hilarious.
That makes me think of when you mentioned you were at the movie theater and some people got up and go, hell no, and like
and just walked
and
out.
They like left.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh, I love that.
Yeah, so adults that know their limits.
Speaking of knowing your limits and hell no, I did not say hell no to this other movie, which I texted you about. I think it's the follow-up to Talk to Me, Bring Her Back.
Oh yeah. But I was like, did you go to the theater without me? How did you see it? And you're like, no, I hijacked it.
Yeah, a friend maybe has it.
Yeah.
And I watched it. But
we're not going to name or admit.
No, maybe. These are all possibilities of what happened.
So I was like, oh, I'll totally watch it. And I'm like, oh, I can't.
Well, whenever you can. But it is hard to watch. It was crazy, but also so fascinating. And the lead actress, she's like, I want to say was at least nominated for an Oscar. So she's like a, you know, Toni Collette type of person who's just has all of this film experience and just like is all in on it in a film. And you could tell. So it was great. But
that's terrific.
But I left feeling like I'm scarred for life.
What was it called again?
Bring Her Back.
Bring Her Back. Okay.
Yeah. That was insane. Mm-hmm. So. Anyway, our next movie.
Oh, yeah. So I
do a little explanation for our reasons.
We have, over the years, already done quite a few of our favorite top Stephen King films.
Some well and some not well.
Yes. But, yeah, our first episode ever was Carrie. And if you're new to the podcast, please don't ever listen to episode one. We hadn't figured it out yet. But we've done Carrie. We've done The Shining. We've done Pet Sematary. We've done It. We did Misery and Gerald's Game. We've done Children of the Corn. So we've done a good number of Stephen King. But, you know, since, like, truly, you know, 95% of his stories have been made into film, there's still a lot more out there. Mm-hmm. And Stephen King's birthday does fall in September. September 21st, if I'm remembering correctly. And so I am hijacking the month of September this mm-hmm. year to hit up some Stephen King stories that we haven't done yet. And so what we're going to start with is Salem's Lot, mm-hmm. Which I'm going to take the lead on that, which is kind of ironic because we all know how I feel about vampires.
You love them.
I love them. They're my favorite. But the fun thing about Salem's Lot is it's been redone a couple times. We're going to, you know, focus on the original mini. It was a TV miniseries, only two parts, mm-hmm. That aired in 1979, if mm-hmm. I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
And then there was, it was remade into a new TV miniseries in 2004. Mm-hmm. And then a film came out just in the last couple years mm-hmm. That is still available on HBO Max, I think.
Yeah, it stars Bill Pullman's son. Mm-hmm. And he's he plays the Ben Mears author, yeah, he plays the lead character.
Yeah. So and they're all very different and varying, but we'll talk about that next time. So, yeah, if you are a Stephen King fan, then you got to make sure to tune into the next two episodes and check out any or all of these iterations of Salem's Lot before we dig into it.
Yeah, I'm excited. I love Stephen King. We're both huge, huge. I mean, Katie more than me, probably, because she's read probably most of his work.
I just bought Holly. Yeah. Which, you know, is bringing back the Holly Gibney character from the Finders Keepers, Mr. Mercedes trilogy. But yeah, my policy. So my Stephen King, I do own all his books that have ever been published in paperback. That's my criteria, because my collection started with the books I inherited from my mom because she was a fan.
Yeah.
And so the first, you know, two dozen Stephen King books I have are, like, you know, printed back in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And they were all the pocket paperback style. Yeah. And so then when I started adding to the collection myself, my goal was that I wanted them all to be pocket paperback. Well, not many of them get printed in pocket paperback anymore.
That's tricky.
The dimensions are different. Mm-hmm. But I also am cheap. So when he publishes a new book, I do wait until it's released in paperback before I select it.
Yeah.
With the one exception of the one that was gifted to me by my student at the end of this year, mm-hmm. That I've already talked about a couple of times, that she gifted me the hardcover copy of that one. So,
and you're like, ooh,
take it back.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. So yeah, Salem's Lot. Check it out. Yeah.
I'm excited to talk about it. So.
Me too.
All right, bye.
Bye.